listening to ThePorchDrinking.com's The Porchcast podcast, brought to you by First Draft Taproom and Kitchen, located in the heart of Denver's Rhino Art District at 1309 26th Street, featuring a pour-your-own draft system with over 40 incredible beers to sample from. And OnTap Credit Union, crafting individual financial solutions for people who brew great beer, the breweries that produce great beer, and the communities where they all reside and do business. The Porchcast is also supported by Latitude Financial Group, which provides financial planning and investment strategies so you can start saving money and begin lowering taxes. And finally, Made by Chalk, who can help with all of your brewery branding, logo design, and website design needs. And now, the Porchcast. All right, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to episode 43 of the Porchcast. We are broadcasting live. That's right. We're broadcasting live from Avanti Food and Beverage. A big thank you for them to hosting us today for episode 43. And we're really pumped to welcome Sam Calagione, founder of Dogfish Head Brewery. I'm joined once again. Give it up for Sam.
Thank you.
I'm joined by our co-host, Jesse Brookstein, and Sam Lale, running the ones and twos, making sure our volumes are all good. And nice. we're pumped to talk beer with Sam. How's it going?
Great to be here, Justin. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. All right, we have lots to get to today, and once again, a big thank you to Avanti, but let's dive right into it. We are upon GABF week. How excited are you folks to be back here for GABF? Everybody pumped? Yeah? You guys got a lot planned? They just, the Brewers Association just released the pour list. You can find that on the website to find out and plan your routes for the week. But also, you know, GABF isn't officially GABF until Sam Calagione touches down here in Denver, I feel. So thanks to kick off the festivities.
I love the GABF. I love it. When we opened in 95, Dogfish was the smallest brewery in the country. We opened making 10 gallons at a time. I knew about the GABF, but I couldn't afford to go to it. And the first year I went to it was 97, when I could finally afford to go to it. I had this existential moment when Charlie Papazian, the founder of the homebrewing movement in America and the man who started the Brewers Association, came to my booth. And my dad and I were sharing one hotel room. It's all we could afford. And I had a raison d'etre and chicory stout on tap. And he came up, and Charlie tried the raison d'etre made with raisins and beet sugars and really loved it. And the next guy came up and drank it and spit it out in front of my face. And I was like, I don't know what's going to happen, Dad, but...
I think Charlie had the right.
I think Charlie had it right. On yeah. That okay. One, but I love the GABF.
Well, yeah. It's speaking of that topic, you know, we talk about how GABF has grown over the years. This year, now featuring over 800 breweries. In your perspective, what's been the biggest changes? What have you seen over the years through this massive festival that's grown?
I'd say, I mean, the scales certainly changed, and my hat's off to the Brewers Association on keeping the flow and logistics as strong as it proportionally grows bigger. But the energy has not changed, and it's so cool to see, you know, on that floor, whether it's distributor, you know, in this room I know we have distributors, retailers, beer lovers, restaurateurs, fellow brewers. But I love how you can always get a sense of what breweries have awesome energy around them, and I love the fact that it has nothing to do with scale. That gives me hope that it doesn't matter how big your brewery is, if you come correct with quality, consistency, and doing well-differentiated things, you can create excitement for your brand. So I think the GABF's an awesome microcosm for that.
Absolutely, and I think this year is truly epitomizes that, as we're seeing a lot of smaller breweries finally getting a chance to get some more accessibility to having an end cap booth. I dropped into the hall earlier today, got a little preview, and saw some really awesome booth setups for small local breweries. Yeah. So it's really exciting to see that. Now, it's been a big year for Dogfish Head. You guys have had a lot of big changes, also a lot of big additions. So I want to jump into some of that and get your take. And, you know, I know a lot of us out here aren't as closely connected with the Northeast, so we'd love to hear your perspective. But first off, you all opened a new brew pub. Tell us a little bit about the Rehoboth Beach location.
Yeah, so we, as I said, we started with a tiny little 10-gallon system in downtown Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. And a lot of folks from Rehoboth here, pretty cool. And that's still sort of the soul of our company. Our Milton facility, our production facility, we have our bigger distillery, our bigger brewery. That's kind of the heart of our company, the big Oregon, pumping stuff out coast to coast. But the soul, where we do so much R&D and interaction with coworkers and customers to evolve our brand, happens at that Rehoboth location. And it was 22 years old and really in need of a evolution. So we raised the old building. We did a very seafood-oriented component on one side of the property called Chesapeake and Maine, where 100% of the seafood sourced directly from fishermen in the Chesapeake and Maine regions. And on the other side, we have our new Brewings and Eats with a world-class stage, world-class five-barrel brewery, and beautiful little 150-gallon distillery as well. So we have that in Rehoboth. In Lewis, we have the first full-service beer-themed hotel in America called the Dogfish Inn on the harbor in Lewis. And then 7 or 8 miles north, we have our bigger production brewery in Milton.
And I have to mention the inn for a second, because our good friend Ryan Hannigan from Focus on the Beer, I believe him and his now wife were one of the first couples to come and actually get their wedding rings made at the inn. Is that, I think, is that a new package?
We do a package with our friend Heidi Lowe, an artist that we're great friends with. You can stay at the hotel. It's a very DIY experience,
sure.
And you make your own wedding rings.
That's incredible. If you, for all of those beer geeks out there that are really wanting to take their relationship to the next beer level, you can go and make a wedding ring at the Dogfish Head Inn. Yeah. So that's really exciting.
Equally exciting, my good friend Todd Alstrom of the Alstrom Brothers at Beer Advocate. Todd used to live in this city with his wife Candace. 2.5 years ago in room 24, they got pregnant at our hotel. So,
all right.
You can reserve room 24, very lucky room.
Is there
room.
A plaque or something? I feel like it should be memorialized a little bit.
Suffice to say, we haven't run one of those special lights over the room to see.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
Now, big year for you as well. After 7 years, you finally received the James Beard Award. You know, Dogfish Head has had such a strong history of culinary-inspired beers. Tell me what it meant to you to be recognized in such a way.
Yeah, so it was wonderful to be nominated for so many years, and there's been two other brewers that have won it in history, and so shouts to Fritz Maytag, who started Ankersteam. He was the first brewer to win that award many years ago, and my good friend Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn won it 5 or 6 years ago. So, you know, we recognize it's an award for all of Dogfish, not just myself. And, you know, when I got texts from folks like Mari Batali and Mark Vetri and chefs, they all said, because of our leadership in bringing culinary ingredients into the world of beer is why they voted for us. So that warmed my heart, because 22 years ago, people were spitting out our beer with raisins in it in the GABF. And now to see how far, you know, we did the first fruit-infused IPAs, you know, distributed in America, Aprop in 97. I went to an event like this where different brewers got up and talked, and I served it with one course, and the next brewer got up after me and said on the microphone, I think fruit belongs in your salad, not in your IPA. So we've come pretty far, and that award was meaningful for that reason.
That's awesome. And also, I want to hear a little bit more about, you know, what inspired these culinary beers. You know, so much is, I feel like beer has really evolved over time in the public awareness of appreciating the pairings of beer with food. And from a culinary standpoint, I feel like beer is just so much more diversity when it comes to a comparison with wine. And I feel like people are really starting to gravitate towards that nowadays. How did you all get into these culinary inspired beers to begin with?
Well, we intentionally opened our brewery in a commercial restaurant with a big open kitchen, so that customers could see, you know, beers, liquid food, and that we weren't doing anything out of a freezer. Everything was coming fresh in one direction out of that kitchen on a plate, you know, towards the table as food, or it was going out of that same kitchen in another direction on a tray or in a 5 gallon bucket for an ingredient in a beer. So we've just always treated beer as liquid food. It's been a lot of fun, and it's so cool to see so many other breweries now painting outside of the lines of the Rheinheitsgebot. We have other brewers at this table. Do you guys have some beers you're super proud of that you're making right now that are brewed outside the Rheinheitsgebot?
You know, oddly enough, the ones that I'm most proud of are probably within it. I really, yeah, like the traditional, like some Swedish lagers and stuff like that that were brought to Sweden from like Bavarian brewers. Yeah. But yeah, we've definitely got the adjuncted beers. We've definitely got a fun fruit-infused stout on tap. You know, we're doing a lot of barrel releases tomorrow. So yeah, but I really appreciate the cleanness of German beers as well.
Yep. Does the Scandinavian beers you're doing have unique grains that come from that part of the world?
We didn't go that far so much. We just took the history of, they had stale hops, you know, older hops, because it wasn't a great region. So we kind of just dialed down the hops a little bit, made it more focused on maybe some oats and stuff like that, and just made this kind of amber, copper, unique lager unlike anything I've ever had. So
cool.
It was pretty fun.
And a quick shout out to Jesse. For those of you who aren't as familiar, Jesse Brookstein, one of the co-founders of Call to Arms Brewing. Really tremendous brewery up in the Highlands in Tennyson. And they've got a number of fantastic events throughout this Great American Beer Festival, including tomorrow you will have a big event.
Tomorrow's the second annual FNCTA Catalina Wine Mixer. So we seek a lot of inspiration from Step Brothers and other Will Ferrell movies. Maybe that's part of the reason we get so many cease and desists. I don't know. But so we're going to have 9 different wine barrel age and port barrel age beers on tap. A collaboration with True Brewing is one of them. Pretty pumped about that. It's an old Kuit, which is another antiquated style, which we really like. And we have Barrels Beer Co. on tap, LZ May B. And then, yeah.
That's exciting. Now, nice. Continuing on to talk about this big year for you guys, Dogfish Head, you know, this iconic brand underwent such a significant rebranding this past year. Tell us about the decision to kind of change the look and feel of the brand.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't change like our logo or our doggy font, but we did try to make our packaging more uniform. And, you know, I got to thank our distributors, folks like Breakthrough here in Colorado, who said, hey, Dogfish, you know, everyone loves how innovative your beers are, but perhaps be a little less innovative with your packaging and bring a little bit more, you know, uniformity to it. Not the ingredients or the liquids themselves, but just where you put the logo on a six-pack, where you put the call-out to the beer style and the ingredients. So we worked with a great company based here in Colorado called Interact, where we said, hey, we're not doing a rebranding. We're keeping our logo. We're keeping our font. We're keeping our wording. But we do want to do some design updates. And it's been really impactful. For example, beers like Namaste, our white beer made with orange flesh and lemongrass, you know, didn't grow at all last year. All we did was change the packaging. We didn't make it a bigger priority at all. And it's growing 14 or 15%.
Oh, wow.
You know, year to date, in a brewery our scale, about just under 300,000 barrels. That's a significant change in the trajectory. Midas Touch, another beer like that as well. So, yeah, the refresh on the design stuff has certainly been valuable for us this year.
Now, you mentioned Midas Touch. I want to touch on that real quick, because that beer has such an interesting history behind it, and literally, you know, a lot of your beers focus on some of that historical background. I think I was reading the Brewer's Table, or I can't remember which book, where you wrote the intro about going out to Egypt and actually finding these ancient ingredients. We're starting to see that now. Avery actually had is working on a big movement on ancient ales as well. Tell us how you got into sourcing some of these ancient ingredients, and also ingredients from all around the world. Tell us about that impact. And how you can translate that and recreate history through beer.
Yeah. So it mostly came from, you know, again, in the mid-90s when I'd show up at a beer fest with a fruit IPA or chicory stout. It wasn't cool. Like, I'd get made fun of, or people get mad at me for screwing with traditions of brewing. And that kind of got me researching what brewing looked like globally before the Rhein-Heizgebot. And for listeners out there that might not know the Rhein-Heizgebot, that's the Bavarian Beer Purity Act of 1516, where the government mandated beer could only be, you know, grains, hops, and water. Yeast had not even been discovered yet. And it's, in essence, a war the Bavarians won. You know, within centuries, the vast majority of beer sold commercially around the world either was brewed in accordance to the Rhein-Heizgebot, or referencing it in the case of American light lagers that also added you know, corn and rice. So I started researching stuff going on around the world pre-Reinheitsgebot, and on my own, I just started bringing out back like African tej made with honey and tree roots and gruets in the mid-90s and braggots, and that our little special focus on that led to work with Michael Jackson, the beer writer, which eventually led to work with molecular archaeologists that could analyze residue found on crockery and tombs. So we started getting involved with kind of reverse engineering beers discovered in tombs around the world. Midas Touch was the first of them.
So would you consider yourself more of an archaeologist or a brewer now at this point?
I mean, we love looking backwards for creative inspiration as much as we like looking forwards in our own imagination for creative inspiration. We have a beer we do every couple years called Chicha. That's a Peruvian or Central American specialty where instead of using temperature ramping to convert starches to sugars, human enzymes in our saliva have that same capacity. So we chew for 24 hours Peruvian blue corn, make cakes out of them, let them do the conversion overnight, and then we brew that beer with strawberries and tree seeds and our saliva, and we make a beer called Chicha there.
And I believe Chicha is actually pouring on the festival floor this year, correct?
Yeah, we'll have it at our booth. So if you're salivating for a saliva-based beer, come to our booth.
You can come out to the Dogfish Head booth and try it out. I also want to talk... big year in the news for you guys. And I know, Sam, back in June, you issued a statement to Untappd wanting to pull the Dogfish Head brands from the app after the announced acquisition. Rate Beer after the announced acquisition by Anheuser-Busch. Tell us a little bit about the importance of that decision and also, you know, what happened afterwards. I know that they announced that essentially this was open property to the public. It's publicly sourced, and so I believe their decision was that they weren't going to be able to pull those beers.
You know, it's an ongoing discussion. I give Joe, the founder of Rate Beer, credit that we have an open dialogue. We're frankly underwhelmed with their reaction because we said, look, this is no longer an unbiased source for media, beer media, or information or consumer information. They said, yeah, it is. And we said, okay, well, then we want to write on our part of your page that we don't think it's an unbiased source and we no longer support this. And interestingly enough, the information we put up there disappeared the next day.
Oh, really?
So if it truly is an open-sourced environment, they certainly proved that wasn't the case. So we're going to continue to fight it. And, my buddy Jean, who owns Cantillon in Belgium, has expressed his discomfort. My buddy Logan, who owns Beavertown in London, a bunch of American breweries. I think what's important is just keeping the dialogue going. They have, you know, Anheuser-Busch obviously has way more lawyers than we do, and they've obviously chosen to fight this. But as long as we don't just go away and we keep the fact that they're oppressing this public, it kind of shows what they're doing in the beer market, not just in the fact that they're not just buying out breweries and still presenting them as if they're indie craft breweries, but they're buying out media sources and presenting them as their independent media sources. They're buying out homebrew supply companies like Northern Brewer and presenting them as if they're still independent. So there's just a tremendous lack of transparency and authenticity that I'm glad is getting addressed finally in everywhere in the craft brewing community.
Now, you bring up a really important point. I want to touch on the importance of independent media. You know, Porch Ring absolutely is an independent media. We started about five years ago.
Independent beer media.
Yeah. But you're starting to see publications like Beer Necessities and the October Project emerge that are fully funded by Anheuser-Busch and the ZX Ventures. You know, what kind of impact does that have on consumers when you start allowing these entities to influence content in that way?
I think a lot of the influence is going to be hard for the consumer to see, right? Because on the face of it, they're not going to be saying that they own these sites. It's not what you see when you go to them. But in the back room, they now have access to all this data, you know, trends of different beers, unrate beer that they might buy out or they might block the ingredients of, homebrewing trends of ingredients that are hot from Northern Brewer suddenly get gobbled up by the faux craft breweries that they sell. So it's a little bit more, you know, cloaked what the effect is, but the effect is very real, and they're going to be very intentional about not bringing that effect forward very early. It'll creep into their business practices, is my guess, as time evolves. And I guess as long as it's legal, regardless of ethics, I guess if I was, you know, an investor, I'd say, oh, great, they're figuring out a way to amplify their competitive position. So I even though I frankly think it's unethical, if it's, I guess it's for our government to figure out if it's legal.
Oh, you know they're on the side of small business, aren't they? Yeah. I don't know. I mean, even myself, who reads a lot and like really cares about the industry, I find myself sometimes coming across an article online only to find out later that it is an outlet that's got some Bud influence in it. And isn't Good Beer Hunting, I believe, has...
Loose ties.
Yeah. But ties nevertheless, right? Yeah. So you always, I mean, even when you read national magazines or newspapers, there's always somebody behind the curtain. So you always have to wonder who's pushing the buttons.
Now, this brings us to, you know, we convene probably twice a month and record a podcast about twice a month. And each time it seems like each episode is chronicled by some kind of major acquisition or some kind of consolidation or private equity. You know, the face, and not to say that any of that is negative, but the face of craft beer is undergoing a severe change right now. From your perspective, you've been a part of this industry for so long. Where do you see this trend continuing in terms of consolidation and independence? And, you know, the Brewers Association has launched a big initiative for the independent brewers label. Where do you see this industry in 10 years?
Oh, I mean, I want to start by saying I'm super glad that the Brewers Association is stepping up with the SEAL program. And I think over 2,000 indie craft breweries have signed up to support it. We're one of them. And I think it'd be really effective on the shelf the way, you know, gluten-free and, you know, organic, these signifiers that consumers can look for to differentiate. And again, it'll just keep the conversation going. You know, I sit at our hotel every Saturday that I'm home and I do a fireside chat with customers that are staying there. Obviously, it's a fairly, you know, craft beer centric demo that's staying in a beer themed hotel, most of them, but every week someone brings up the question of what breweries are independent, and someone will say a name like Ballast Point or Devil's Backbone, and some people around the fireplace are like, I didn't know that wasn't independent. And if someone knows a beer is owned by a massive brewery and they don't give a shit and they want to still buy that beer, God bless them. That's what's great about America. But what bothers me is seeing how many people don't know. And I think that's all. Consumers deserve to know. And I'm glad the BA's stepping up in their efforts to smoke that out.
Oh, I'd almost say the video that High End came out with against that label was almost one of the funniest things to date. I mean, that armada's coming across the ocean with wine cannons and rifles full of spirits. So we'll see, man.
Yeah, we talk often about that video, and you know it's bizarre to me that this the leader, the biggest producer of beer, feels like they have to take shots at the little guys. You know, punch up, don't punch down, and so it's bizarre to us to see their reactions in that way.
But I guess that means we're all doing our jobs pretty well if they're watching us.
That's right.
Yeah, and I would say with the growth of the industry, the explosive growth, especially over the last, I guess, 5 years, I think the BA has really done an incredible job of keeping pace with the industry as a whole, and as you mentioned earlier, the GABF. It's amazing that they've been able to wrangle all of these different breweries, all of the judging competitions. I know anything this large can always be criticized, but I really do think the BA is doing an awesome job.
Agreed.
Now, tell me a little bit, as a journalism nerd, I kind of geeked out when I heard that you were going to be the executive editor for Palette Magazine. Tell me about how that project came about. And I know that, unfortunately, Palette is no longer with us, but very intrigued about, you know, you have such different focuses, and I feel like you have so much invested in all these different areas. How did Palette come about?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, I went to school for a little while in Sydney, Australia, and got to know some of the brewers down there when I went back, and have a great love for their beer culture and just music, art culture down there. And some really great magazine publishers from there contacted me with theoretically what sounded awesome, and we were very proud of how it turned out, which was sort of like an Atlantic or New Yorker for beer lovers, where not all the content was about beer, but it was content that we thought beer lovers would love to read about while they were drinking beer. And they asked me first if I'd invest, and I said no, because I didn't want to pierce that. I said, don't pay me, but I'd love to be an executive editor, and you guys can cover any beer you want, but the only way I'll be executive editor is if you don't take dollars from the world's biggest breweries. You can cover them editorially, but because I believe in the Brewers Association's definition, I did have that thing where I said, you can carry the magazine on without me and take big brewery dollars. But ultimately what we learned is the economic model of running a big, thick, glossy, you know, magazine without big company dollars was challenging. So I told them, look, you know, I'll just take my name off the masthead if you want to take the money. And they, to their credit, said, no, we were really proud of what we did together. Someday we might try and do it as a hardbound book. So it's not dead, but the quarterly publication, the financial capabilities was unsustainable.
Well, I want to say that as a journalism geek, I really do feel like that was some really great work that you guys were producing there, because you know, we kind of strive on Porch Drinking's front to balance the line of reporting about beer, but also telling great stories and it weaving in other elements such as music and pop culture, because we want to make beer accessible, we want to make beer fun, and so, you know, I think Palette did a really great job of capturing that too.
Yeah, right back at you guys. I mean, we're beer to be beer geeks and not beer snobs.
Absolutely,
is something we all need to
embrace a little bit more. Yeah, for sure. Now, speaking on the topic of music, what are you listening to? I know you're a big music fan. One of our close friends, Virgil Dickerson. I know he used to send you all records all the time. And so, what are you listening to currently?
What's Virgil's label? It had a house on it.
Yeah, it was Suburban Home Records. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Shouts to Virgil.
Yeah,
great taste in music. What are we listening to in our house? Let's see, the new album by The National, LCD Sound System's new album's pretty great. That I've been listening to, Waxahachie, an indie Philly band. We have a festival called Analog A Go Go, where we invite our favorite indie record stores to set up on our campus with cask beer in between each of those, so you can drink, you know, rustic cask beer next to flipping through vinyl.
That's awesome.
And that's the first week in November. Tickets for sale at dogfish.com.
It wouldn't be a Porchcast without some kind of shameless plug.
And Waxahachie's playing it this year, so I'm psyched about that. Obviously listening to some Tom Petty this week, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Rest in peace. What an amazing, amazing artist. We're running out of Wilburys.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's insane to see his catalog sustain over time, and also introducing new music throughout the ages, so that you have all these different generations that have grown up with Tom Petty. So really tremendous loss this week. Finally, I want to touch base. You know, we're here in Colorado, and clearly you have strong ties out here. I interviewed you once to talk about big beers, Belgians and barley wines. That's always, you know, one of our favorite events to attend. But also, you and Adam Avery go way back to the early ages of that. Tell us about a little bit more, just in general, about your ties to Colorado and why you call this place kind of a second home in a sense.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I guess it mostly centers around the event so many people in this room are taking in this week, which is the GABF. And really, before social media kind of started taking off, the GABF was a place you could come and make a big impact as a small brand and create excitement in a room that had the right distributors, and the beer geeks of every big town in America were the ones that would fly to the GABF in the late 90s and early 2000s, right when social media was taking off. And then they'd go on Beer Advocate and back in the day Rate Beer and say, hey, I was at GABF and I tried this crazy beer from this little brewery in Delaware. So for me, I do think our brand's been very lucky that we've built a lot of excitement even when we were tiny, and a lot of it has to do with the beer culture of Colorado that I think is direct lineage from Charlie Papazian starting his homebrew classes at a community college in Boulder, to the Brewers Association opening and the GABF being here, and just concentrics out from Falling Rock to where we're sitting right now, Avanti. Just awesome, awesome, unparalleled beer culture in this state.
That's fantastic. Anything else that you guys want to add in?
I mean, I think I would say it's the more I have this conversation with you, the more I think maybe you might have had a strong influence on where I stand as a brewery owner at this point, because though we're not making chicha, though, you know, Avery tried recently and they failed so miserably. I don't know if Adam would ever let you know that, but I don't even think...
I'll bring it up with him tomorrow.
I think they ended up having to cheat the system a little bit. That's a whole other conversation.
They cheat the system.
I think we're... Whammy.
The beer industry wouldn't be the beer industry without awesome puns.
Yeah. I know. I think we've gotten to a point where we're talking about adjunct in every single style of beer you can possibly imagine, and people are wondering if we're running out of styles of beer that can even exist. And I think there's just so many styles that we don't even touch on, like the Kuits, like the Swedish lagers, like the Chichas, like these old beers that you're finding that are in these old vats in the buried in the desert. And I just think the future of craft beer could actually just be the history of craft beer and all these styles that we have yet to dig out of the history book. So
what goes around comes around.
What
you guys, you and True, did a collab on a gruit. What are the specialty ingredients in that?
Yarrow, bay leaf, and rosemary. And it's fun. It's got some notes of like maple, ripe apple, so, and aged in red wine barrel for about 5 months. So, you know, and we have another kuit that we did with Upslope Brewing that we put yum berries in, because those apparently are a thing, and that's Prince Yummy Yums. So I think we're the only brewery ever in the history of mankind that had two kuits on tap at the same time, so take that.
You're cornering the gruit market.
We really are.
There's a bunch of weird warlocks and wizards from the 15th century rising out of their graves to come drink at your tasting room.
It's a pagan ceremony.
When people start asking us what the next big trend is, we're going to say moving on from New England style IPAs to gruits, and you guys are going to be on the forefront.
Thank you.
Call to arms. Yeah,
thank
right
you.
There. Well, Sam, I really appreciate you taking time to join us today. Once again, a big thank you to Avanti Food and Beverage for having us today.
Avanti.
Thank you to our crowd. Thanks for joining us. We're over here sampling, I think, four-year vintages of 120-minute IPA. So there's still time to get down here and try some of this beer. And lots of other fun Dogfish Head beers on tap as well. Sam, thanks for coming out. I know GABF is always a big special moment for you, so we appreciate you taking time to join us. And a big thank you to our co-hosts as well, Jesse Brookstein, Sam Lael. This has been episode 43 of the Porchcast. I'm Tristan Chan. Be sure to check us out on porchdrinking.com. You can follow us at porchdrinkingco. And be sure to follow us on iTunes, Stitcher, and whatever listening devices that you have. And a big thank you to all of our sponsors.
Check all you right. later.
Good job, team. That's a wrap, Sam.
That's the
one. That was fun. Thank you guys for having me on.
While many of you out there are stowing away bottles of bourbon barrel-aged stouts, lambics, and other wilds, it's equally important to stow some money away for a rainy day. Saving money and paying off debts are two of the biggest New Year's resolutions for 2017, so do it the smart way. Go to latitudefinancial.com, start saving money and lowering your taxes today. Go to latitudefinancialgroup.com to schedule a complimentary meeting now. Once again, that's latitudefinancialgroup.com. Made by Chalk specializes in creating brand experiences for the craft brewing industry, including here at Alamo Drafthouse. They actually did the website for Alamo Drafthouse's Barfly and Littleton locations. From product packaging to websites, apps, and events, Chalk services are tailored for independently owned craft breweries, maltsters, and industry-related consumer products. If you're looking for premium branding for your brewery or a new concept for your web design needs, visit madebychalk.com. Once again, that's madebychalk.com. Whether you're planning to build out a larger beer cellar, shopping for a new home, or buying a new car, OnTap Credit Union provides the tools and services needed to help with any major life transition. Learn how OnTap Credit Union can help with home loans and streamlining financing for a new car. OnTap Credit Union also specializes in crafting banking solutions for you, the people who brew great beer, people who drink it, and the communities where they all reside and do business. Find out more at ontapcu.org. All right, folks, we often talk about First Draft Tap Room and Kitchen. They're the Pour Your Own Draft system located at 1309 26th Street here in Denver, Colorado. It's basically the adult version of Froyo. You can go in and try as much or as little as possible of up to 40 different styles of beer. It's your Pour Your Own Draft system, so you can pour a little bit or a lot. It's basically like going to a beer festival, but at a draft room location. They've also got fantastic food. So visit First Draft Tap Room and Kitchen, Pour Your Own Draft system located at 1309 26th Street here in Denver, Colorado. Once again, that's First Draft Tap Room and Kitchen.